For coming to the last, this is the last Crash City seminar of this academic year, and it's a special event today. We're featuring not one speaker but three speakers, and this is the sort of this event is also kind of plays the role of our sort of obligatory Olympic theme. We thought we should have something sort of vaguely Olympic themed, since we're the City seminar and the Olympics are in London. So this is sort of indirectly, sort of in a non-vulgar manner, Olympic themed event. And so our guests today are Professor John Milner of the Courtauld Institute of Art in London. He's the author of Vladimir Taplin and the Russian Avant-Garde, as well as numerous other books on the sort of visionary art and architecture of the Soviet 10s and 20s. Since we're here in Crash, it's worth mentioning that Professor Milner is also a co-chair of the sort of similar sounding CRAC, which is CCRAC, to spell any doubts, which is the very vibrant Cambridge Courtauld Russian Art Centre, which has organised numerous events examining the history and continued relevance of Russian and Soviet art in Cambridge as well as in London. And Professor Milner is also a close neighbour of the Orbit, residing as he does in the vicinity of East London's Victoria Park. So this is, you know, the Orbit is a presence in the lives of many Londoners, perhaps. Or not. And then we have Rachel Dagnall and Simon Polly from Henry VIII's Wives, an artist's collective primarily based all over the world, but in Rachel's case in Oslo and in Simon's case in Copenhagen. Is that the right way around?
Yes.
Yeah. And Henry VIII's Wives have been carrying out large-scale ambitious art and research projects examining the legacy of Taplin's unbuilt tower since 2005. This project is called Taplin's Tower in the World, and it received a lot of publicity. I remember seeing posters for on the Tube in London a few years ago featuring Taplin's Tower, obviously. And it's sort of, as far as I understand it, and this is something I checked with Simon just now, the aim of the project is basically to build Taplin's Tower on a one-to-one scale ratio, but in bits and pieces, sort of all over different parts of the world, to sort of actualize its transformatory potential, but in this kind of diffuse form. And the project included a 2008 exhibition in East London's Whitechapel Gallery, as part of which the Whitechapel Gallery's shop was outfitted with a kind of foyer of the Taplin Tower, with the sort of, as far, I mean, you'll probably show some pictures of it.
Yeah.
Funky hats and sort of little corporate style communist souvenirs. So that was a very exciting project. The idea of this talk basically is to compare the legacy of the Taplin Tower in the context of the Orbit Tower, which has been built in which has just been completed in London's Olympic Park. I think the Taplin Tower is something that's always fascinated architects and artists since its inception in 1919. But something that's definitely sort of been a part of the artistic and the sort of the urban imagination for a long time, and consistently so. But I have a feeling that it's particularly of interest now. There seems to be an intensity of interest with which people are looking at the Taplin Tower in the last couple of years. The Royal Academy just did a big exhibition at the end of last year and at the beginning of this year, which included a recreation of the Taplin Tower in the courtyard. Some of you may have seen that, a sort of very impressive red Taplin Tower stood in the courtyard of the Royal Academy. And there's various other things. I just sort of came across these things. This thing I found on a building violations website. It's a Chinese. It's in Kunming, the Chinese city of Kunming, a five-star hotel completed 3 years ago, which features the sort of Taplin Tower theme on its roof. This is the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei's Fountain of Light and Descending Light, these kind of subversive chandelier-esque interpretations of the Taplin Tower. This is obviously, you know who. this is the head of the, this is the Polish TV headquarters, completed in 2008, sort of rather controversial building, designed by this kind of rabidly right-wing anti-communist architect, who openly sort of admits and was very amused by his own sort of joke of having put the Taplin Tower into the corner of the building. This is a sort of IKEA's response to the Arsenal Mittal Orbit Tower, also in Stratford on the Olympic site on the Grand Union Canal, I think. So there is this sort of this, and obviously the combination perhaps of this new obsession with the Tapping Tower is this thing here that we're going to talk about today. So I mean, sort of what we want to sort of wonder about. I mean, we're supposedly in the sort of post-utopian, pragmatic neoliberal moment, although in a sort of very austere incarnation of this moment now, with economic crises and such things. But for some reason, even though we're in this sort of this non-utopian moment, we're fascinated by these sort of utopian structures. And the question that we want to ask is what the significance of the Orbit Tower is in this. It's a sort of Boris Johnson vanity project. It's a Lakshmi Mittal corporate conduit. It's a sort of self-aggrandizement effort for Lakshmi Mittal. Certainly, it is all of those things. But what else is it? Is it indicative of some sort of longing to return to some kind of utopian idea, or is it sort of the evidence of the final co-optation of longing for utopia by some sort of bizarre floppy head corporate municipal state kind of evil cabal? So this is the kind of question to pose at the beginning, not necessarily to answer. And I'd like to invite John Milner to do his talk. Actually, we wanted to show this. Sorry.
It's all right.
I completely forgot. I haven't actually seen this yet, but Ed reminded me of to show a clip from the Guardian website, which shows this thing. Should we watch the whole thing?
Yeah.
Until we get bored. If people start getting bored, then just stick.
Yes.
Yeah.
5 minutes and then we'll stop watching.
Can we lose the light a little bit? You might.
Yes, I think actually the light switches are just.
It sounds all mute.
Oh.
I've lived in Newham for nearly 70 years. The Olympics is rather sort of upmarket, and that is not too upmarket. It does reflect there a bit more than it would if we had a Sasha Wellington there.
It's not sophisticated, it's not. It's nothing. It's just a nothing.
In itself it's a nice thing, but in this area, Newham, there's a lot of room for improvement on a practical level before you can get to, you know, things like art.
Once it will open, I would like to go there and have a, I want to see from the bird eye view.
The Orbit came about through what is already a kind of cultural legend of our time. Boris Johnson is said to have met Lakshmi Mittal, steel billionaire, in the toilets at the Davos World Economic Forum and persuaded him of this to put money into doing something really daring and audacious for the Olympics in London. Mittal has paid 19 million, 3 million has come from the public purse. There was a competition to find exciting, bold design, which was won by Anish Kapoor, one of Britain's most famous artists, and Cecil Bauman, outstanding designer, working together to create something which is, well, it's certainly novel. Is there a different responsibility in architecture from sculpture in terms of the impact on the environment, the sort of what local people feel about it and all that?
Well, this is the only object on this site that doesn't have a purpose, in the sense that, you know, it's not a sporting venue or anything else. It's there for experiential reasons.
What kind of building would you like it to be compared with, ideally?
Well, you know, there are mythical buildings. There are two of them, of course, the Tower of Babel and Chaplin. Inevitably, both, if you like, built or only built in the imagination, let's say.
Actually, the closer you get, the more it looks like a homage to Chaplin.
Well, I don't think it does.
No, it doesn't.
Chaplin's readable. I mean, you know,
Tapping Tower being a great image of Soviet idealism.
I understand. So what we're doing in a way is this: if comparisons are to be made, I'm not talking aesthetically, but otherwise, this is sort of unbalanced. an object sort of...
I mean, have you tricked Boris Johnson
into
building a communist symbol?
Ah, yes, there we go.
Well, standing here, I mean, it's a fantastically bold blood red, kind of organic. It's a bit like Hieronymus Bosch's painting, The Garden of Earthly Delights. It's like these kind of like weird organic buildings that you see in that landscape. It's got something phantasmagoric about it. And the redness really does hang there in the sky, and it also gives it a fleshy warmth. So it's got something of the body about it, and as well as something of fairgrounds and helter-skelters and Greek Orthodox churches and anything that's a bit kind of spiralling and crazy. Hey, look at this! I said it was more than a boom platform. Well, this orbit is a tower of surprises, obviously. We're just at the bottom of it, we haven't even got inside. And underneath it, there's this great, basically, classic Adish Kapoor sculpture, a huge overhanging kind of trumpet. We've seen the blood red capillaries and veins of it. And this is this, I don't know, well, you could say this is its arsehole, but I don't know, this is its, this is, there's something quite rusty and physical and fleshy about this kind of trumpet, which seems to be about to suck you up into the building, like it's going to hoover you up. I said it had nothing to do with the Olympics. I mean, people say it's got nothing to do with the Olympics. Maybe it has, because maybe it's all about the human body. This is different. You get this mediated view through portholes, which is a bit, it's a bit more interesting and different from if you're in a glass elevator. And this is a bit like the Pompidou Centre at this point, actually, all these bits, you know, kind of postmodern accretions of horns and things that you have on the Pompidou Centre. Well, we're now coming out onto one of the viewing platforms, and it's the second floor of the building, and we're going to go into the great media scrum. So obviously you get up here, you see yourself in a mirror, and you see the city before you. Canary Wharf. We've got certainly a pretty all-encompassing view of London. Amazing, actually. This circular viewing platform, which is closed in with glass. I mean, obviously, this is when you realise it is a building, as the designers explained. I mean, it's a building that has to conform to all safety standards and so forth. So there's nothing particularly crazy going on here, just a very well-designed, expansive, glass-in viewing platform from which we can see Canary Wharf, and then a walk follow it around. And really a great vista of the city. I mean, when you come out this part of London, when you come out, you know, obviously in East London, you do get these fantastic skies, don't you? Which are really, you know, when you really understand why Turner, the painter, Turner was a Londoner. It's £15 to visit the orbit during the Olympics. But you do get this fantastic view of the stadium. We're looking down on the main Olympic stadium. So presumably you can buy your ticket and stay for a while and see a few Olympic events from a distance, but, you know, a unique view of them. The thing about these wonky mirrors, concave mirrors, is that they magnify you. And so they put you on the same scale as the city, which is a really interesting idea. I mean, maybe this building's got saying something about people in the city, that Canary Wharf is behind me. We're looking out on this vast metropolis, but at the same time, any sense of being dwarfed by that is counteracted by the enlarged vision of the crowd itself in the mirrors. Well, here we are at the top of the stairs, and from here visitors can walk all the way down a kind of great spiral, which we're about to do. Final thoughts on the building. Architecture is a very strange thing because it's sort of visual, but it is also physical in that your entire body is involved. You walk through a place and you get your response to architecture is a kind of response to space. It comes from in your body as well as in your mind. And on that level, I really like this building. I love this building, actually. I really do feel that it creates a sense of play, a sense of freedom, and you feel good in it. You feel good in it, and you feel expansive in it. And actually, it does have a function in the Olympic site because it's a feel-good building. It makes you feel good being in it, and that has to be great for the party atmosphere that the Olympics hopes to create. Has it fulfilled what you hoped, you think?
More than, much more than. I think it's far better than I thought it could possibly be. I was worried that it, you know. And it's scary, it's astonishing, it just blows you away.
And you're known for your fondness of classical culture. it's kind of anti-classical, this building, isn't it? I mean, it's the opposite of a Roman temple. It is,
but it's very much, it's part of our time, isn't it? It's, but it's the, look, it's the same fundamental concept as Trajan's Column, but it's done in a brilliant 20th century.
Actually, it is a bit like Trajan's Column.
21st century idiom.
Yeah. And is it sculpture or is it architecture?
It's sculpture.
It's almost like a child had taken a model of the Eiffel Tower in a kit, taken it apart and put it back together again, you know, where it's completely kind of nutty. But and yet, which stays up and which is strong and which is structurally sound.
Right now, there's 50% off Regal collection sofas, and as always, there's 4 years.
That was great. Great job.
Okay, so I think your presentation is to someone here. Yeah. Thank you.
Hello. Good to be here. Good to meet a fragment of him and Yates and his wives. And I followed for some years now, tackingthistownoftheworld.com as an information source. And I love the idea of matching the ambition of Tatlin with the idea of building life science and making some progress on that, really, and taking over the world in a way. And all of that is really exciting. And I love it in a way, but it's quite also quite serious and challenging undertaking. This tower that we're looking at today is made of steel, and it has a steel magnate as its patron. And I just want to mention in passing, because I've been learning about this play for many years, and I only ever caught up with it last night, the Hairy Ape by Eugène O'Neill is all about steel, working in the bowels of a transatlantic liner. And some of the action is done in a rather Meyerhold-like biomechanical way, very rhythmic, shuffling and so on. So I mention it to you because it has that Packard-like simplicity of an agitational piece. And at the Southwark Theatre, it takes place in a theatre that's then got three rows of seats, really. It's very gripping. So here's a Hairy Ape, this Irishman who works in the bowels of transatlantic liner, and who gets to visit Fifth Avenue and all the rest, and he doesn't fit in anywhere. He's been visited by a beautiful, wealthy steel heiress, the steel magnate whose father built a ship, who had built half the skyscrapers of New York and all the rest, and it's all about steel. So we have something a little bit similar to what here. This extraordinary commission. Let me just see if I can do this right. Shall I just leave it up? Yes. This is, you've seen this popular kind of free newspaper, Anglia, that's for sale alongside Australian and other kinds of free newspapers. And it intrigued me to see the Mittal Orbit Tower appearing in the Russian press without any mention of Tatlin, and this idea that it may be some kind of bizarre showpiece that won't last for a very long time, or it's a chef d'oeuvre, the Russian version of a chef d'oeuvre masterpiece. And this is one of the numerous questions I want to pick up on in the next few minutes. What I've done is I'm making some fairly obvious comparisons, then asking some questions which we might relate both to the Tatlin Tower and to Anish Kapoor's construction that we've just seen wonderfully illustrated in the film. Whether it's a building and all that kind of thing we can look at in a few minutes. So to follow up this, here is a slide of Tatlin with the model of his tower, identifying with it, although it was a collective work in many ways, and there is a sign on the wall that actually says who the collective were that put it together. it was in some ways a feat of engineering, but equally it was obviously woodwork in the studio of the Academy of Arts in St. Petersburg. So it was a very ambitious bit of handicraft, apart from anything else. There is a little wooden model of it in the Socialist Bookshop in Gower Street, if you're coming out of Great Russell Street sometime. It's rather beautiful, like a little clock. So this is quite a big model, and it's in the ceramic studio, or is it the mosaic studio of the Academy of Arts in St. Petersburg. And it was designed, as you probably know, but I'll say it anyway, just from that this indicates the river. It was to step over the river Neva, and it was to contain the Parliament of Planet Earth. One of the great things about it was that if you didn't eventually... if it didn't work well, the Parliament, that is, it was suspended over the river, so you could lose it fairly quickly and easily. But a magnificent object pointing at the pole star, so vastly ambitious in many ways, and a monument to work, very much a political monument, to the Third International, the idea that the proletariat would take over not just Russia, but the entire world. So we see here Tatlin identifying with this great project. One thing we should acknowledge about Anish Kapoor is he said it himself. He built one. Tatlin built a model of one. Mostly, as with the Royal Academy the reconstruction by Jeremy Dixon, people make models, make constructions of the model rather than the thing itself. And Henry VIII and his wives are making the thing itself, which is to transform the world in its own way. And Kapoor, Anish Kapoor, did at least make a tower. So it's an ambitious. And obviously, as Anish Kapoor pointed out, the tower evokes various images from the past, including that of the Tower of Babel. Now, the reason it's worth looking at this for a moment is that, of course, the Tower of Babel was the feature of the biblical story of what happened when people were reaching for the skies and suddenly no longer able to speak the same language to each other. In many ways, Tatlin's tower was an attempt to reverse this so that the nations of the world could come together and there would be a new kind of language. We are talking about years just at the end of World War I, of course, when there was this great internationalist feeling, although internationalism for the Soviets was perhaps better, different rather, than it was for some other people. But let's bear that internationalism in mind for a few minutes. Reaching for the stars, this vast ambition, we can see easily enough when you look at some of these towers rising from the ground. This was a very mysterious object for quite a while at Stratford. It was like a great, fish net stocking or something, climbing up into the sky. And of course, there was another base for it as well. Quite an astonishing thing to see growing because of the angle and because of the subtle computerized structure. It was pretty well unpopular, I think, from the start with locals. And in a way, it is something that was true of the Eiffel Tower in its day as well, much despised by a lot of people in France in the 1890s. And clearly, as a couple have said, the Eiffel Tower is still something of a comparison in this kind of tower. It's worth noticing, however, that the Eiffel Tower comes out of an international exhibition in Paris, a trade exhibition, really, where it had a lot of art in it, but it was to mark the 100th anniversary of the revolution, ignoring all the various monarchs and arrangements that had gone on in between, and to revive an image of French culture after the disastrous defeats of the Franco-Prussian War and after the bloodshed of the Paris Commune. So in a way, under the new republic, the Eiffel Tower, it seems to me, was a combination of demonstrating French engineering skill and elegance at the same time. It's at this point, really, where France again takes up this rather 18th century idea of being a feminine city, elegant, feminized. There was a pavilion of the woman, for example, in the 1900 exhibition. Addressing the world is something the Eiffel Tower was meant to do, therefore. It had little Somali villages, it had other great pavilions all around it, and was a world fair. So we have this global theme from the start. And it continued to have this impact, certainly up to World War I, still does to some degree. This is a little agitational poem by Apollinaire from his Calligram book, which I think was 1914, in which the poems make shapes, and the shapes make the poem. A kind of futurist cubist arrangement, in a way. Salut monde, hello world. Addressing the world, sorry. Salut monde, je suis la langue éloquente, from I am the eloquent tongue. Que sa bouche au Paris tirera toujours aux Allemands. Hello world, of whom I am the eloquent tongue, whose sticks out from the mouth, O Paris, that will stick out, sticks out and will stick out always of the Germans. So this is the Eiffel Tower as a tongue. It has many evocative images associated with it, and as a revolutionary, as a national monument. In a way, Apollinaire was picking up its agitational potential in the war years. But before that, the idea of engineering as something overwhelming, as sublime, as something that dizzies the senses, an experiential phenomenon, as Cahors was discussing. You can see very clearly in Delaunay's images of the Red Tower. Red, because that's the red lead that keeps the rust at bay, basically. But leaping over the buildings is still an amazing sight, of course, when it suddenly appears. Now, Taplin certainly visited the Eiffel Tower, and he would also have seen Big Wheel in Paris when he visited there before World War I. But his project is not quite engineering. He did say that if they went ahead, he would employ engineers. So he clearly thought of himself as something other than an engineer. In fact, he was a sailor, he was a painter, he was a sometime wrestler, he worked on stage, he did all kinds of things, but he was by no means a trained engineer. So this is a kind of utopian diagram to some degree, and a lot of thought's been spent in thinking about it and the structural potential and the movement of these great rims which go up to the Taplin's Tower of the World Radio Station at the top here, which was to project government decisions back to planet Earth. So a vast building, unbuiltable, completely unbuiltable then, and unbuiltable now except in pieces. So in a sense, there is this sublime ambition. And seeing it, it was never seen. People have evoked it in many ways. But the imagination of travelling up its elevators, up the spine, of seeing its great decision-making activities of the world harmonized into one great Soviet globe, of making it the cockpit of planet Earth and its orbits around the sun, was a fantastic resolution in this single image. And it makes the city of Petrograd, St. Petersburg, look very tiny underneath. became famous at once as a design, and it lives very effectively in the mind, and it can be argued that this is a construction for the memory, for the imagination, for the mind. And existing only in photographs meant that it could be transmitted by a photographic and publication means very widely and stick in other people's minds. So it's assertive, persuasive thing in a way. But it is the embodiment of the idea of taking over the entire planet. So it is certainly political. And ships were to sail into Petrograd under these great archways. So, but not, but not, and not, no. Good job, Nico. This has to be. Oh, it's that. Right, got it. Now, there's a clarity in the Tachyon drawings, very big drawings, working drawings for the model, which you can't see here. So, and it may be that Anish Kapoor's tower is, I forget what, in some ways, but it may not live in the mind with anything like the same clarity. So one question we might think about as we go through the next hour or so is whether it's Tachyon's tower was the work of a collective, which he clearly led. And he posed in a way as a worker among this group, designing a social structure. This was what's so unique about it, having this idea of communism built into it. Not as an individual artist or painter, really, so one might wonder about Anish Kapoor. Is he operating as an artist? Does he have quite different aims? Does he relish the idea of being a worker or an engineer? And is this work collective? Does it have some political dimension? It doesn't appear to reach for outer space. It couldn't take up the one of the Soviet slogans about workers of all planets unite. It doesn't have that fantastic kind of ambition, and it is maybe a kind of fairground excitement to some degree that you see here. But I can imagine that it is a sublime and overwhelming experience when you're in the depths of this mechanical structure of Anish Kapoor, as you see here. And one might wonder who pays for it, and what's it for in terms of other people's needs, or did the Soviets need Tachyon's tower? Did Tachyon need a major commission? Did Anish Kapoor need a major commission? Did Mittal need a major commission, and so on? Some of these questions are quite easy to answer. But there is a uselessness about it, which is often a sign of a great artwork, and there are some features to it which are readily recognisable as borrowed from elsewhere to a degree. One thing the Tachyon's tower performed was addressing the world, and this idea of a podium from which to announce ideas and news and persuasive dicta you can see in many of the photographs. Here's Lenin speaking just after the revolution, for example. And the radio station in the hemisphere on the top of the tower would have performed much the same function and would have, in principle, been projecting the news onto the clouds. There were these great towers in Moscow within a year or two of Tachyon's project. These are by Uncle Shukhov, who was an engineer. And this tower is still functioning as radio mast in Moscow. This is engineering on a grand scale, a fantastically clear and inefficient, and efficient.
And John, while we have this on the screen, could you indicate the rough height compared to the Tachyon tower?
We have Muscovites here who might know the height of the tower.
Maria, do you have any idea of a radio tower? There aren't any convenient people going by here. We could.
I'd say less than one of the little Roman groups is the person.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So.
So you can wait that easily from that.
Hockney said at the opening of his exhibition at the Royal Academy that rather embarrassing in a way, but it's a good point to make. He said, I wonder if the Academy needs me, or do I need the Academy more? But this is a very interesting thing to say. It showed his arrogance, I suppose, but his confidence. And one might wonder if Anish Kapoor needed the project more, or the other way around, than the Olympics needed him. There is, some of the photographs of the Kapoor Tower are rather beautiful in themselves, and some of them do conjure up a kind of engineering romanticism. Here's a recent Jeremy Dixon computer generated image of the Tachyon Tower in, I think, the wrong place, but it's not very easy to know, straddling the Neva in Petrograd. So the tower is still haunting people, and it still keeps coming back, so we'll talk about that continuity in a few minutes. But its political damage was much clearer than Anish Kapoor's tower. It was part of this entire determination to take over all the consciousness. This is a Lissitzky graphic work in which it says, workers of the world unite, and here are the five major continents around it. This was an overt plan. This kind of internationalism was quite different from what we've been looking at. So we might think about this public voice, this appeal to the world. Does it work? Is it something crucial in these towers? And does it apply to Anish Kapoor? It's addressing the world. Obviously, athletes and visitors from around the world are going to come to this thing and go up it. Whether it has a clear message in the way that Tachyon's tower did is another matter. It raises questions about the role of sport and art, sport and work, sport and politics. It has this sense of the sublime, and it was interesting to hear these ideas about something to play with, something not so serious in an overtly political way. This is a crowd, computerized crowd of little computerized people, which shows you its enormous scale. And they are all anonymous. They are a million crowd, they're an invented crowd. In the Russian context, there is this theme of the crowd, the masses, which appears in a lot of photographs in the revolutionary period and into the 1930s. Here they are, anonymous, and being organized, in this case in Red Square for some political meeting. Organizing the crowd is something we hear quite a lot about with regard to the Olympics, with the klaxons for organizing and so on. It is very clearly police, and as we know, there are fighter planes at Norfolk airstrip just north of London who will hardly have got off the ground before they reach Victoria Park and Hackney. They will be turning around over France in order to come back again. I don't know what they're supposed to do if there's trouble. And also there are rockets. So the crowds are going to be very firmly organized. Now, in terms of the Russian context, this is political organization and persuasion. But there are various aspects of this I think are very interesting. Watching the crowd became a recurrent theme in a lot of Russian photography in the 20s and 30s. Here's the most famous example, still from The Man with the Movie Camera, where the two cameramen are watching the crowd and showing it as a film to people in cinema who are thereby seeing themselves and seeing a new social development emerging. But here's Rodchenko looking at people looking at sports people, a sort of double observation. And the sports people are getting immaculately organized to go on a parade in Red Square in Moscow. So we've moved in a few images very rapidly from a crowd as just an enormous gathering of people, so a crowd was organized into some kind of politically effective arrangement, to sport and to organise groups of athletics in major and spectacular performances. Now, in Rodchenko's photographs, these look quite like the sort of geometry of his paintings, and this, in a way, is making superimages out of groups of sports people. These sports people are only parading. They're not running, jumping over things. They are parading, and they're parading in a military context. So there's an organization of people here which doesn't distinguish very closely between the artwork and politics. And the displays, even within the Dynamo Stadium and so on, the Fizkultura athletics, are minutely modulated, visual and sporting and athletic and acrobatic works. They are very elaborate evocations of dance and of all kinds of things. But they're not overtly sporting activities in the way you think of it. And sport's clearly being used as a propaganda medium here, and there's nothing worries these people about displaying images of their great leader in the midst of these athletic activities. They can even form towers of peacock. There is such a thing. And equally, the image of big, anonymous, geometric figures, genderless automatons, is very common. This is a Lisitsky figure in his press exhibition in 1928 or 29 in Cologne. Workers of the World Unite, big five-pointed star has become an embodiment of the political regime, and in a way a sign of Lisitsky submitting to political persuasions, really. Does this apply in any way at all to this figure, or is it just fun? Is it still just for frustrated potter scatter? Well, the idea of anonymity is very evident in Russian sport imagery. It is often geometric, anonymous, robotic, and if you believe in a material world, without religion, without psychology as we know it in the West, you can think that human beings are simply material creatures, then you can love your car. You know, a man on a bicycle is quite something, and the sportsman can be a mechanical creature, albeit faceless, anonymous, geometric. These are Lisitsky sportsmen. These are Rodchenko champions wrestling England and France. And in a way, even photography could respond to this kind of thinking, because an individual high jumper like this becomes a motif in construction. And some of the propaganda for the Spartakia, the Soviet equivalent of the Olympics, has this very inventive conversation with Stalinist principles built into some of its promotional literature. These are postcards by Klutzis. This is another one for horse riding. Uncle Joe Stalin, motorcycling, and all the rest. And sorry, this is slightly out of focus. For the unity of the worker sportsmen of all countries. I'm watching sportsmen enough. And they have faces, but of course they're anonymous. And curiously enough, this is a feature of Delaunay's work before World War I, as in the Cardiff team here, with the Eiffel Tower and big wheel in the background, an inspiration in itself to tackling it. But there he is still in his workshop, and there was something collective there, and to be public and political. And this is true of sports parades too. This is motorbike, two athletes, women living dangerously. People becoming a cog in a wheel. And this is fascinating, Rodchenko photograph of the living sign. I remember a teacher at school saying, be quiet, I'm just a cog in a wheel, but now I see the living wheel. And of course, Marievich in the same context in the late 20s producing this anonymity, so this facelessness, this genderlessness, this blank lack of individuality that is the collective image in a way. In sports clothes look like this now, of course, but it's collective in the team sense too. I've almost finished, I'm sorry, I've gone too long. Down with the past. This is Tatlin, caught up in politics very clearly here. And this is the monument to Sofia Pietrovskaya, who was an anarchist who blew up one of the czars. And here they are celebrating with monuments in Petrograd. Here are a couple of photographs of demolishing, dismantling great political czarist monuments. Photographs collected by Rodchenko in this case. Fascinating, beautiful, destructive activities, making very interesting records. But this photograph of Tatlin, who was in charge of monuments in Petrograd, that's how he got involved with the tower really, had employed this man, who's an Italian, called Griselli, the exhibitor of the Italian Futurists, who designed this this rather Boccioni-like head here. But this man is the man who paid for it. He is Anatoly Lunacharsky, who was in charge of Lacombras, the People's Commissariat for the Enlightenment. He paid for it out of Soviet funds. So it's interesting, compared with this fascinating photograph that we saw earlier. Who's winning, you know? Who gains? Who's paying? And the little film we saw was quite right to introduce these questions, but it's quite an interesting comparison. Something much bigger than a simple opportunism, I think, is at work here. And so down with the past, destroying the past as a gateway to a new city. Here it is with the skyline on the South Bank in London, a familiar image, and of course the festival hall dates from that time. It's best, if you're going to be destructive and revolutionary, to have a bit of the old world in the background to overwrite, if you like, with a new regime, a new style. Here's a fascinating Malevich photo montage of one of his architectons defeating New York, flying weightlessly past the old skyscrapers, just by an act of will, as far as we can tell. But it's overwriting it, you know, it's asserting something new. And this is an interesting echo. This is by Zaha Hadid, who is a great fan of Malevich architectons. And this is a work of hers from 1977 called Malevich Tecton Painting. And of course her work, including the velodrome at the Olympic site, is very complete and orderly and elegant and it's a single fascinating piece compared with the messiness of the tower. It's very interesting to drive past it. But the tower still haunts people, so one thing we should try and account for is how does it keep coming back, this tower? Why do people keep trying to re-envisage its colossal proportions and so on? You can see the heritage. Now I thought I'd finish with this comparison. This is the crown sculptor with his model. I think he's not an engineer. He may be trying to change the world in some ways, but it's not. It's much harder to see the ideology of the world in which you live. Much easier to look at someone else's world, to see it. But probably as time goes by, it will become much clearer when one looks at a photograph like this. Here is Tatlin as a simple worker in his collective, probably a fraudulent kind of posed photograph in a sense. And his idea of building the tower, as you see here, was very much handicraft. This man had a rather brilliant engineer designer working with him, and all the steel to hand from the man who was paying much the largest part of the building. So I'm going to stop. Thank you very much. Whether people like it or understand it, so
it has had quite a bad press, I think.
Getting better, I think, the press.
Yeah.
I think it's rewarding to it.
But now we have creative people doing something quite different. Maybe.
Let's see.
Kapoor did say he wanted to show instability, for example.
Maybe I should say a little bit about why we're interested in the Tatlin Tower and we've heard a little bit about what we're doing, but how we got started in, involved in trying to build the whole of Tatlin's Tower, but in pieces around the world. We were working on an exhibition in 2005, which was called Populism. And it was a series of exhibitions in different European museum venues. And we started thinking about the Tatlin's Tower as a populist project. And so we came up with the idea that it would be really good to try and build it in pieces as public sculptures wherever it was possible. And so that was the kind of proposition. But we didn't know if it was going to be possible to realize it at all. I mean, it's pretty big, and we're trained in environmental art or public art practice, so we know that just to put up a little tiny sculpture in a public square or shopping centre is like a project which takes a lot of money, a lot of administration, and a lot of time. So we were more interested in putting forward the idea of building Tatlin's Tower in full scale, but in pieces, and seeing if people would pick up the project and take it on board. And so we were actually quite surprised that it gained so much momentum, because we knew that everybody knew about it. We knew that architects and artists learned about it, and planners know about it, but we didn't know how interested people were in actually realizing the project. So one of the first things we did was make a series of posters, kind of playful posters where we try to engage people's help. So this was one of the first posters, which was kind of made in this graphic style, which was supposed to fit in with a futurist, or a kind of, yeah. It was supposed to work together with the tower.
Ironically, our colleague Lucy, who can't be with us today, it was through the Platform for Art that we got a chance to make the posters. But they didn't. That first poster, they didn't think it was artistic enough. So in that case, we had to make something more artistic.
we made a series of posters like this in this graphic style, and they didn't approve of that really, and they wanted something which was a bit more artistic.
Mm-hmm. So that was Transport, whatever it was called then. Transport
Platform
for Art. Platform for Art.
Yeah. Which is an arts organisation working together with the London Underground. So they get all the unsold advertising boards, and then they invite artists to make projects for these
does it exist as a platform artist?
Yeah, it's kind of been reduced, but it still goes. At that time.
It's more of a Ken Livingstone thing than Boris Johnson thing.
Yeah, it's more of an idea. So this project, you can't really see it, but there's a website address here, which is Tatlin's Tower in the World .net, and it's supposed to encourage people to go into the website and find out what it's about. I mean, the first posters were more like, we're going to build the Tatlins Tower, can you come and help? And this one that was there was more sublime, in a way, I guess. You don't really know what it's about. So a lot of people got in touch and they said that they wanted to help. And so we made contact with a lot of different people, and when we had opportunities, we would get in touch with some of the people who expressed their interest and ask them if they wanted to make something for an exhibition or something for which is related to a promotion of this new build. And so this is from an exhibition in Bern at the Kunsthalle, where we proposed building this piece of the tower in the middle of the Bundesplatz. And they and then we made a radio, a kind of pirate radio from the Kunsthalle, where we had a kind of jingle.
We had a musician made a jingle from England. And then we had this propaganda that was tapping the tower would have also had. The plan was to have a radio station and lights that projected onto the clouds with the propaganda.
So this exhibition basically dealt with that kind of propaganda element of the tower, and using that to try and promote it so that people could get involved. And we went around and interviewed people and asked them if they were interested in getting a piece of the Tatlin Tower in Bern. And it was a really mixed response. A lot of people were really interested, and then a lot of people were not interested when they found out that they'd have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And then, so it was really quite mixed. But there's the radio sender. These are quite dark images. This is a section of the tower which we actually built in Belgrade. And when we realised that we were actually going to build a piece in steel, we needed to get in touch with people who could design it, engineers, and we needed to find out if it would have been possible to make the tower and how we're going to make all the pieces. And we needed to locate sections of the tower that we could then take and make into sculptures. And so we got in touch with a Japanese architect. He's like a research architect working at MIT, and he's made Takahino.
Takahino and Nada.
He has made a series of films which actually visualise the tower as it would have been.
There's actually a some images in the Guardian film or actually his film.
That's the one with the birds on, isn't it? Which people talk about.
Yeah.
They're all
academy.
Yeah. So it's probably there. Because you didn't do any creaking or anything like that. You know, we're talking about doing shopping for something, birds whistling as they went by. Very good one.
So at the Kunsthalle, then we invited him to come and talk about his film and about the unrealised tower. We invited several people who were interested in the idea of unrealised tower to come and discuss it. And then he let us use some of his images to produce this piece of sculpture in Belgrade. And this was in... it was part of an exhibition which was put together by the British Council and the museum in Belgrade, which is to do with humour in British art, or contemporary British art. So, in a way, it wasn't a very serious project. We wanted it to be seen as a serious project, but in that context it did have kind of absurdity to it. But that's the sculpture when it's finished. Here is an information plaque which shows you which part of the tower it is. It localizes it on the diagram and tells you about the project. And what has been important for us is to promote the building of the tower continuously. So through whatever channels or opportunities we get, we kind of keep pushing it. And so here it would be like, if you want to build a piece of the tower, then get in touch. Yeah, just keep on.
What was
get sponsored by Max Steel, which is like an American. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been possible because it's quite a lot of steel.
Did you write it to Lakshmi Mittal as well?
No, we didn't.
But the museum ran with this. They picked up on it and they ran with it themselves. So they basically did it effectively. And they made a film about the opening, which we could show.
We could show you a bit of. And what's interesting about this and what we wanted to actually talk about was like how the project has been received in Eastern or ex-communist countries compared to here. Like how seriously it's been taken on board and how much effort people have put in to realize this sculpture in Belgrade and in Moscow and Lithuania. We had really positive responses. It hasn't just been a turd in the plaza kind of experience, it's been something really important. So I can show you a bit of that film, but maybe maybe we just talk about the Whitechapel project first and then we can go back. We were invited to make a project for the street, which was a gallery or an exhibition space that the Whitechapel had put up while they were doing all the renovations in the gallery. And so they invited, I think it was 12 different artists to make shows throughout the year. And so we used that opportunity to make a foyer for Tatlin's Tower, so that you get the illusion when you go in there that you're going into the foyer of Tatlin's Tower. And we wanted to engage or make all these little gadgets and things out of all the local kind of industries.
Or industries in the East End of London.
So that we kind of trace these trade routes backwards. Yeah, that was the idea. So we made this bell is made in the Bell Foundry at Whitechapel, and these uniforms, these hats are made at a hat maker in East London as well. And the uniforms were made of batik, which we got printed up in Ghana, actually. And it was quite funny because I sent all these images of the Tatlin project to Ghana and asked them to make a batik pattern for the fabric. And then they sent back this design. You can't really see these images, but...
It comes later, doesn't it?
With Tatlin, and of course the background pattern is quite related to the tower, but I contacted them and said, no, I think you've got the wrong idea, I want you to make something out of it, I want you to make your own kind of pattern. And it was, of course, a real kind of honour to have the artist or the person on the boutique.
Because so many of the local people in Whitechapel were from Africa, worked with us.
Yeah, but he thought that it would be an honour to have Tatlin on the or in the design, whereas we thought that he'd kind of misunderstood the brief, and that was quite interesting. I think that what we're interested in is like making all these products to promote the project. But at the same time, we're learning a little bit about our context and location and trying to locate Tatlin's Tower in that place. So we'd also been in a series of meetings with Tower Hamlet Council about making what are they called? Manhole covers, which would cover the radius of the tower. If the tower had been built in the Whitechapel area, then all these... would be the exact
footprint.
Yeah, there would be a footprint of the tower. And they were quite interested in doing that. And then we got engaged in a dialogue about building a sculpture in one of the parks or building a piece of the tower in one of the parks in relation to the Olympic games. But that didn't materialise. Of course, funding is like the main issue when it comes to making public sculptures. And we didn't have backing to do that. But it was quite interesting being involved in all these meetings with them and finding out what they were interested in and what kind of scale they were interested in producing or developing a sculpture. is actually from the last manifestation of the Tao project, which was in Moscow. It's really bad contrast. It looks fine on my screen.
If you turn the lights off, that's basically
bad. Could you turn it on?
It's
all
way
designed, this building takes everything away from you, there's no control.
They go on automatically when there's people in the room, there's like a sensor as well.
Environmental
determinant.
Of the tower that we proposed could be built in Moscow. And then we made this silver jewellery, these small pieces here
trinkets.
Are trinkets, silver trinkets, which are sections of the tower, which we then spread around in various places. This is at the Czechia Museum, where the model of the Tatler's Tower is. So we left them there for people to pick up and take with them so that they could then think about the project and talk about the project and maybe find ways to develop the project. But, this is what's interesting for us is that when we're invited to do an exhibition, there's usually a limited budget, and we have to find ways to make and promote this project within that budget. We have to be creative with that and find potential solutions to this brief. There you can see, that's the main shaft of the tower.
Should we show the first part there?
Yeah, we can do it. Should we find it?
Do people feel that they become members of something?
I think.
Do they meet each other?
No, not yet.
Not really. I mean, we've thought about making some theatre with like different possibilities. We made some music, and I think people feel like they have some kind of ownership or some involvement in the project, but I don't think that they have a membership.
Thank you.
website, which is not particularly well updated, but it's possible to go in there and find out the background and
perhaps we should show the unveiling.
Yeah.
It shows that for us that you can see how seriously they take over in the Old East compared to what is happening in London with Mittal's project, which is referencing to the Taplin's Tower. There's no political reference. You can see in the unveiling speech here, how seriously they take it.
Komunistička internacionala nastala je posle moralnog sloma socijaldemokratske druge internacionale u Prvom svjetskom ratu i pobjede oktobarske revolucije. Nalazeći uporište u Sovjetskoj Rusiji i idejama Vladimira Ilića Lenjina, revolucionarne snage okupljuju se marta 1919. godine u Moskvi i osnivaju novu komunističku internacionalu. U razvoju Kominterne reflektovalo se izrastanje i sazrevanje svjetskog komunističkog pokreta, njegovi usponi i porazi, plime i oseke, politička dostignuća i promašaji, unutrašnje kontroverze i taktički zaokret. Kominterna je izražavala osnovne težnje i zahteve revolucionog krila radničkog pokreta. U njenim idejama i organizacionoj strukturi ogleda se antagonizam prema socijaldemokratskoj tradiciji i svakom obliku saradnje sa kapitalističkim poretkom, kao i težnja za ubrzanjem revolucionarnog procesa putem organizovane akcije. Zbog toga je do svog ukidanja 1943. godine komunistička internacionala izrasla u milijonsku organizaciju koja po rasprostranjenosti i ideološkom uticaju nije bila premca u novijoj istoriji.
So I guess for us this kind of
internacionale nije dovršeno.
Is the complete opposite of the tower that's been built here in London. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with the capitalistic component of making public monument. It's more to do with the idea and the realization that something which has been this utopian
So I don't know whether whether the proper thing to do would be to see the climax, or to see gratification.
Of the hole would have been the target, and it would have been in the manner of O Tatlin and Kapoor and O Boss and the Tower of Babel painting and every other painting that we've seen, to actually go for the whole building as a World Enterprise UNESCO kind of World Heritage thing, whereas O Tatlin is, as you have pointed out, they're not merely a Russian, not merely a communist, not merely an international figure, but he's perceived by modernism, by Italian and futurists, by everybody, as a kind of example of a utopian idea. So I think it ought to be made as a whole project.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a completely different project, to make the whole tower. And I think what we were actually interested in is whether it would be possible to build all these pieces, or if people were interested in if you could actually get the momentum to build the whole tower in pieces around the world. If you managed to do that, what would happen then? If the whole tower was built in its completeness in pieces around the world, would you then be able to put them all together and make the tower?
But are they not all of a different scale?
No, they're all built exactly
to scale.
One to one.
That's the whole point.
With the materials
being
identical and the engineers being identical.
No,
not necessarily
the same engineers, but what we've tried to do is find out how the pieces would be built if it was part of the whole tower. So we've tried to use the right materials and tried to use what we're using the right scale. So that's the idea, that they could potentially be put together. So it's more of an idea, it's more of a concept than actual.
But we're also pushing it through, from our perspective, pushing it through the art world. You know what I mean? It's going through the most commercial, artistic, possibly through that world. You know what I mean? That in a way, take a piece of the communist, you know, dream, and then put it through a completely capitalist system.
Mm-hmm. I think the idea of it being in fragments also kind of reflects like sort of globalization. That, you know, when you have a product like a television and it's made in its components around the world, and then it comes, you know, comes together as a television in a certain place, which probably wasn't the case in 1920.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could be really kind of cynical and say, you know, you can have the whole tower if you've got enough money to pay for it. But as far as we're concerned, we're never going to get enough money to pay for building the whole town.
But isn't the whole point that Mittal hadn't had the money, and still has the money, to realise the project? It doesn't have to be Anish Kapoor. It could have been,
but it wasn't.
But this is interesting also, because the Lakshmi Mittal, the Kapoor Tower, is only 115 metres high. And I think, I mean, for me at least, and I've talked to a few people about this who agree, it's such a sort of bizarre and outrageously kind of crazy, wacky thing that you're sort of, I would think that its impact would be much more substantial if it was bigger.
Mm-hmm.
It almost looks a little bit sort of,
mm-hmm.
it looks a bit sort of stumpy now.
Yeah.
Kind of Toyland.
Yeah, it's too condensed,
well,
it's too sort of pressed together. If it was bigger, then it would
be,
it would have this sublime quality, this sort of, this kind of unquantifiable.
Yeah, but that is Russian. And the British is this, the kind of Wind in the Willows, the Alice in Wonderland, the militarization approach. I mean, when they say in Belgrade this is a festival of humour, I can see the same feeling coming over Belgrade. Mm. And I mean, this ironic speech that the man was giving, he can't have been serious.
No, it was an nostalgia kind of thing, wasn't it?
Yes, he's just ironizing the whole, we are backing the Third Communist International.
I don't know if he was completely doing that. That's what we thought at first, but then we kind of...
He isn't ironising at all.
No, we don't think so.
Really?
No. We think they're completely serious. Completely serious. And that has been quite an eye-opener for us.
But this was done in the Museum of Contemporary Art, wasn't it? Who was the guy? Was he a curator?
They're from this organisation called the Slobodna Kultura.org. I don't know who they are. But they took up the whole thing and wanted to make it into a real ceremony, and it was really important to do it properly.
Was he not from the Communist Party?
Yeah, I think he was
a Communist political party.
But I mean, in Poland, for example, if this had been done, and it was done with a gallery, then perhaps this kind of speech would have been made, and maybe the gallery would have even invited a member of the Communist Party to make the speech. But they still would have framed it ironically in their sort of catalogue material. But perhaps in Serbia.
I think it was something like that. But I think he was really quite serious. And I think the gallery were really serious about making it, and it was really quite important. But one thing I want to mention, which I haven't done, and which is quite, is some kind of link with the Kapoor Tower, is this viewing platform. When we were doing the project in Bern, and we invited the architect, the Japanese architect, who is called... We also interviewed some people in Berlin who wanted to build Tatlin's Tower at Tempelhof.
Yeah.
They had been organised as a group for quite a while, and they were... It was an actor, quite a famous actor.
A German actor.
Who we managed to film in the tower, the radio tower in Berlin, while it was going around. And all these elements come up with towers, which are to do with spatial and to do with crowds and viewing and